Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. If you're a woman, you've likely been taught supposed pro tips on how to keep yourself as safe as possible when you're walking home at night. Arrange your keys between your fingers, keep alert, park under a streetlight. Never let your guard down, we're told, not even when you're walking with friends or leaving a place you feel is completely safe, holy even. What's implied with these decrees, whether intentional or not, is that anything that happens to us is because of us, our choices, our shortcomings. Now that's true today. So imagine it's 1944 and you're not just a woman, but a black woman in Alabama. A woman like Recy Taylor. It was a crisp fall night in September when she was kidnapped and raped as she walked home with friends from church. She survived and then had the strength to do what was nearly unfathomable in her day. She talked about it. She did not assume blame. And as a result, her case would not only become one of the most famous sex crimes in American history, but it would create the foundational building blocks for the civil rights movement. To understand Recy's story, we have to back up a good ways, to the end of the American Civil War. Once slavery was outlawed, many newly freed African Americans were forced into a dressed-up form of enslavement called sharecropping. Rather than toiling in fields that they didn't own for no pay, they instead toiled in fields they didn't own for next to no pay. In several ways, their lives had not changed much since emancipation. White landowners still were free to beat and even kill African Americans without fear of reprisal, and they continued to claim sexual access to black women as they had during enslavement. Many white Southern men during the Jim Crow era believed free and full access to black women was their birthright, just as it had been their grandpappy's. This was the world that Recy Corbett was born into on New Year's Eve, 1919. Recy Corbett, better known to history as Recy Taylor, was born in Abbeville in Henry County, Alabama. The Corbett family had been sharecroppers in Alabama for decades when Recy was born, and they were, like millions of others, barely surviving on love and faith. Recy's mother died when she was 17, causing her to have to step in as a surrogate mom to her 6 siblings. Several years later, when Recy was 24, she married a man named Willie Guy Taylor, and soon after gave birth to a daughter they named Joyce Lee. For her spiritual fulfillment, Recy and her family were members of the Rock Hill Holiness Church, a black church where its members felt safe to celebrate without concern. On September 3, 1944, the congregation had enjoyed both morning and evening services full of singing and praying. It was dark when Recy stepped out the door with her friend, Fanny Daniel, and Fanny's son, West. Even though night had fallen, the trio set out on the familiar walk home along the Abbeville Headland Highway that bordered peanut plantations. According to Daniel McGuire's book, at the dark end of the street, Recy began to notice the same car passing them multiple times. It was a rattle-trap green Chevy with several white men inside. Reese had just managed to ask her friend what she thought this car of men might be up to when the car skidded to a stop nearby and seven armed men tumbled out. Leveling their weapons at the trio, they demanded Reese go with them. They claimed someone fitting her description had, quote, cut that white boy up in Clopton, end quote, earlier that evening, and the men had been deputized to find the culprit. One of the men, Joe Culpepper, claimed to be able to identify Reese as the suspect by her clothes. Fanny Daniels tried to intervene to explain to the men that Reese had been either in church or at Fanny's house the entire day. She couldn't have possibly done what they were saying. Herbert Lovett, a private in the U.S. Army, was the oldest in the posse at 24. He stepped forward to tell West Daniels, who was just a teenager, that the group was planning on taking Reese to be identified, and if she wasn't the suspect, they would bring her right back. Obviously, none of them believed this, and Reese took this opportunity to run for the woods, but the same man who was appearing to be the reasonable voice, Lovett, cocked his weapon and pressed the barrel against Reese's head, saying, "I'll kill you if you run." Fanny spoke up. This is her talking in a documentary decades later.
"So don't run," said, "'cause they might shoot you." So she went and got in the car with them, and she said they blindfolded her, and they took her away.
Any hope Fanny Daniels might have still had that the men were legit and Reese would soon be home safe was dashed when the car slowly rolled away without the headlights on. Reese would later remember it like this.
"So the car pulled up behind me, some white boys. They ain't said nothing about what they're gonna do to me. They put me in the car, then went blindfold me. I was begging them to leave me alone. Don't shoot me. I got to go home to see about my baby. They wouldn't let me go."
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
She had been forced into the back seat of the green Chevy by 7 men, 4 of her captors squeezed into the front seat of the car while the remaining 3 piled in after Reese. The car drove for what felt like an eternity to Reese, but in reality was only a few miles before turning off the highway and onto a dirt tractor path. They stopped in the middle of a pecan grove. Reese knew something awful was about to happen. She started shouting, screaming to be let go. She was no match for 7 men. Their guns cocked and pointed at her. They barked at her to take off her quote-unquote rags, or they would kill her and leave her in the woods. Sobbing, she complied, while still begging to be taken home to her husband and child, hoping that would humanize her to her captors. Instead, Lovett, the soldier, busied himself with laying out an old coat on the ground while the rest of the men took off most of their clothing, leaving just their undershirts and socks. Lovett then handed his gun to a friend before turning his attention to Reese, saying, quote, "Act just like you do with your husband, or I'll cut your damn throat," end quote. 6 of the 7 men raped Reese Taylor that night in the pecan grove. Once they were done with her, one of them helped her dress, put a handkerchief over her eyes, and threw her back into the car. They did not drive her home. Instead, they made it to the highway and pushed her out of the car, yelling the instructions, "Don't move until we get away from here." Once the sound of the tires had receded, she lifted a shaky hand to pull off the blindfold. Looking around to get her bearings, Reese took a deep breath and started to walk home. As Danielle McGuire described in her book, Reese's story didn't stop there. This is a story of women coming together, supporting each other, standing against the all-too-common crime of the rape of Black women. Reese was not alone. She had Fannie Daniels, she had her family, and within days, the Alabama branch of the NAACP received news of her attack. The chapter president, E.D. Nixon, opened a file on the incident and promised to send his best investigator to Abbeville. In fact, that investigator knew Abbeville well. Her father grew up there and still had family who lived there. The McCauleys were sharecroppers right alongside the Corbetts and Taylors. It had been years since she had lived there, though. Her parents had been swept up in the great migration of the World War I era and moved north. But the rape of Reese Taylor brought Rosa Parks, who had been born Rosa McCauley, back to Abbeville to act as a paladin and to lay the groundwork for a movement. The fight against Reese Taylor's attackers began as soon as that green Chevy disappeared from Fannie Daniels' sight that night. By the time Reese was staggering along the edge of the highway trying to find her way home, a car pulled off to the side of the road near her. Inside the car was Will Cook, a former chief of police, along with Reese's father, Benny Corbett, who'd been looking for her since Fannie had alerted everyone that Reese was in danger. Benny called out to his oldest child, and she gratefully slid into the back of the car. Fannie had reported the kidnapping to Cook, the former chief of police, because the current sheriff was known to be hostile and violent toward the town's Black population. As soon as West Daniels described the car, Cook seemed to recognize it immediately. While described as the former chief of police, Cook still had some important powers. He was able to initiate an investigation, give orders to wake Sheriff George Gamble, and go to Benny Corbett's house to tell him something had happened. Benny grabbed a gun, put it in his waistband, and ran out to find his daughter. Sadly, Benny knew of several places to search, places known around town where white men would take the rape victims. According to author McGuire, Benny first searched Price's lumber mill, but found nothing. It wouldn't be until hours later, when he was soaked with sweat, that he finally spotted the silhouette of his daughter staggering on the roadside. Will Cook took Benny and Reese back to his store, the site of his post-police career. Waiting there were a few deputies and Reese's husband, Willie. Cook led everyone inside where, surrounded by friends and family, Reese was forced to recount the brutal gang rape. I say forced, but let's be honest here, she could have kept quiet. She was expected to. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!
After she's raped, and they tell her, "We will kill you unless you promise not to say a word," she immediately spoke out.
As Reese would later say,
"I can't help but tell the truth what he done to him."
Staying silent wasn't Reese's style. While she couldn't name any assailants, her description of the car matched Daniels. Cook told the gathered posse that there was only one car in town that fit that description. He returned half an hour later with the car, its owner, Hugo Wilson, and Wilson's father. Both Wilson and the car were identified by Reese, Fannie, and West Daniel. Backed into a corner, the reluctant Sheriff Gamble was forced to drive Wilson to jail while Willie and Reese walked home. Wilson was questioned by the sheriff at the Henry County Jail, where he admitted to picking up Reese and carrying her to the spot. Picking up is an interesting way to phrase kidnapping, but of course, Wilson claimed he'd done nothing of the sort. He named his accomplices, Dillard York, Billy Howerton, Herbert Lovett, Luther Lee, Joe Culpepper, and Robert Gamble. Side note, it doesn't appear Robert Gamble was related to Sheriff Gamble. Anyway, Wilson repeatedly said that while the other six had intercourse with Reese, they didn't force her, they paid her. That was their defense. that Reese was a sex worker and they had hired her for her services. And while it wasn't uncommon for white men to visit black sex workers, this situation was clearly not that. Even the sheriff recognized signs of shock and trauma that had been all over Reese's face. And there were three eyewitnesses saying this encounter was most definitely non-consensual. So surely Wilson was arrested, charged, and arraigned, right? Right. Oh, wait, no. It says here that the sheriff sent Wilson home with a $250 bond. Now, that wasn't a piddly bond. It translates to about $4,200 in today's money. But the sheriff also told Wilson to have his parents sign and return the bond whenever they got around to it. The sheriff didn't call any of the other men, didn't issue any warrants, didn't make any arrests. Returning to Abbeville for the first time in 30 years to this mess, Rosa Parks reached the Taylor's cabin to meet Reese and hear her story. Democracy Now again.
When Rosa Parks went to interview Reese Taylor, we're talking 11 years before the Montgomery bus boycott, the local sheriff kept driving by the house and eventually burst in, threatening Rosa Parks with arrest if she didn't leave town.
Rosa knew that staying could mean more than just trouble for herself, but trouble for her relatives still in town, and even for Reese, so she gathered the notes she had scribbled and left. Arriving back in the state's capital, she summoned some of the most important activists in the civil rights movement, many of whom you may not have heard of before. She had just joined this chapter of the NAACP in 1943 after having an incident with a Montgomery bus driver, the same one she would tussle with in 1955. She had become politically active after learning of the false rape allegations against black teens in the Scottsboro case of the 1930s. You can go to season one to check out that story. After being shooed from Reese's place the first time, Rosa didn't give up the case. Nancy Bursky, a filmmaker who made a documentary about the case called The Rape of Reese Taylor.
She comes back. She interviews her again, and she takes her up to Montgomery, where she forms this committee for equal justice for Mrs. Reese Taylor. And what this does, basically, is it triggers the black newspapers to write about this story. And black newspapers were the only newspapers that were writing these stories in those days. The white newspapers, they didn't suppress it, they just ignored it. It wasn't important.
Among Rosa's peers on the Equal Justice Committee were Edie Nixon, who had worked with A. Philip Randolph with the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, Rufus Lewis, the head of a local funeral home and the head coach of the Alabama State football team, that's a historically black college, and E.G. Jackson, the editor of the Alabama Tribune. Within a year, they had formed what the Chicago Defender called, quote, the strongest campaign for equal justice to be seen in a decade, end quote. A Henry County grand jury was impaneled to hear Reese's case on October 3rd and 4th, 1944. Given the facts, few on Reese's side of the case thought they would actually get justice, but they had hoped to at least have an honest hearing. But that was too much to ask for a black woman in Alabama in 1944.
She did not get any justice. You know, she identified a rapist, but to no one's surprise, these guys were not indicted.
Reese's backers were disheartened that none of the men had been arrested, no police lineup had been arranged to verify the witness statements, and the bond to appear in court wasn't issued until the late afternoon of the day after the hearing, so the accused men were not bound to show up. The only witnesses to give evidence to the grand jury were Reese and her friends and family, and none of them were able to testify under oath to the men's names. According to author McGuire, the entire proceeding was a farce organized by the circuit solicitor, Keener Baxley, who would later become Alabama's attorney general. There was just enough of a hint of actual judicial proceedings that the residents of Abbeville could choose to believe that they had done their due diligence. The grand jury failed to return any indictments against the men, leading the white establishment to believe the matter was settled. For several weeks, Baxley and Gamble congratulated themselves, believing their strategy had worked. Reese and Willie Taylor were resigned to what countless before them had to face, justice was not coming for them. Not only that, but they faced multiple threats against their home and their lives. It began even before the grand jury was impaneled. The very night after Reese was kidnapped and raped, her home was firebombed as she and her husband slept. The Taylors woke to find their front porch on fire. Willie ran outside and put it out, saving Reese and their daughter. The next morning, the family of three moved in with Benny Corbett, Reese's father, and her six siblings. Terrified, Reese later told a reporter that they were too scared to stray far from her father's home, not even to go to town. They were afraid someone would harm or even kill her. Reese's brother Robert said the entire family stayed inside after dark, refusing to walk outside after the last light. He said, quote, "Everybody tried to make sure that they'd done what they had to do in the daytime," end quote. And further proving his hero status, Benny Corbett waited until his family was tucked into bed, loaded his double-barreled shotgun, filled a bag full of shotgun shells, and climbed high into a tree to sit guard over the cabin and his loved ones until dawn broke.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
While Reese and Willie attempted to return to some kind of normal life, and her father refused sleep to guard over his family, news of the attack spread rapidly throughout the country. Black activists carried the story into union meetings, barbershops, beauty shops, pool halls, Bible study groups, NAACP chapters, and, probably most importantly, around the dinner table. The organization and infrastructure that had been scaffolded during the Scottsboro trial a decade earlier, now provided a kind of phone tree, quote, to create a coalition to defend Taylor and demand punishment for the white men who kidnapped and raped her, end quote. That's per McGuire's book. Coming together at the Negro Masonic Temple in Birmingham, activists from both Birmingham and Montgomery shared horror stories and strategies as sharecroppers and steelworkers sat side by side. One organization that worked on behalf of Reese Taylor was the Southern Negro Youth Congress, filled with middle-class, progressive African-Americans, most of whom were also communist, a fact that did not endear them to the South. The SNYC was founded in 1935, and by 1944 was considered to be the most promising civil rights organization in Alabama. Like the NAACP, they concentrated their efforts on investigating police brutality, fought for equal access to the vote, and coordinated campaigns throughout the state. Among its members were the Reverend Martin Luther King Sr. and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, who would be a close compatriot of Martin Luther King Jr. But, as with the majority of civil rights organizations, women were at the heart, whether it was organizing fundraising efforts, interviewing citizens to gather information for cases, or planning future protests, Black women drove the engine. Rosa Parks found natural allies in the women of SNYC. The coalition would all form the aforementioned Committee for Equal Justice for Mrs. Reese Taylor. An indicator of just how wide-reaching this movement became, the committee wasn't headquartered in Alabama, but rather at 112 East 19th Street, New York. Another sign of the significance of this committee, and essentially how Reese began to represent all Black women who were victims of sexual assault, was the list of activists who had joined. W.E.B. Du Bois, suffragist and founder of the National Association of Colored Women, Mary Church Terrell, poet Langston Hughes, sociologist Ira D'Augustine Reed, and John Sengstack, the publisher of the Chicago Defender. Of course, challenging the status quo in 1944/45 meant drawing unwanted attention from the FBI and, in this case, even the House Un-American Activities Committee, which argued that Taylor's committee was a cover for the Communist Party. Undeterred, the committee's mission was to get Reese's story to as many people as possible, with the hopes of pressuring Abbeville to reopen the case. Letters were sent all over the country detailing what happened to Reese and asking people for their support, both moral and financial. One letter, dated February 1, 1945, described Abbeville as the part of the South where, quote, no Negro has any rights a white man is bound to respect, end quote. The author, Henrietta Buckmaster, the co-chair of the committee, described the attack of Reese as a fascist attack that represented a block against our national unity. She said they had to continue to demand equal justice and prosecution of the Abbeville rapists. The committee's campaign elicited dozens of letters and telegrams that were sent to Chauncey Sparks, Alabama's governor. One, signed by 48 students from the University of Alabama and dated February 9, 1945, that's 18 years before the university was integrated, insisted, quote, upon the indictment of the criminals who are guilty of the kidnapping and raping of Mrs. Reese Taylor of Abbeville, Alabama. We are all Alabamians who believe that ignoring such an issue will only make it more complex, end quote. Numerous telegrams are still stored in the Alabama State Archives that had been sent to Governor Chauncey Sparks asking him to do the right thing. One from Cleveland, Ohio, urged Sparks to, quote, exercise his authority in seeing the Henry County Grand Jury does its duty in the Reese Taylor case, end quote. A postcard from Los Angeles said that the, quote, fight for equal rights for the Negro people and for all depressed minorities is the responsibility and duty of every decent, democracy-loving American, end quote. It also demanded Sparks ask for an indictment in Reese's case. A pamphlet called A Plea for Equal Justice was published, telling Reese's story once again and including the names of the committee's sponsors, those who donated their time and or money to the cause. The states represented included Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, New Jersey, New York, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, and Vermont. The sentiment was,
we have to put more pressure on the governor. We have to get some kind of justice.
That was Nancy Bersky again. A Hail Mary missive to Governor Sparks came from even farther away, courtesy of an African-American sailor, Eugene Henderson, who was fighting overseas. He wrote, quote, I have risked my life many times to deliver supplies to our armed forces and allies. My morale drops when I learn that a woman of my race has been brutally raped by six white men and nothing done about it. Why isn't Negro womanhood as sacred as white womanhood? End quote. Henderson wasn't the only service member outraged. Charles Seeley, an editor of the Army News, wrote to Sparks, quote, if this pamphlet reaches any considerable number of Negroes in our armed forces, and I have no doubt it will greatly affect their efficiency. This, of course, will be very bad for the war effort, for it is senseless to fight fascism abroad if fascistic influences are to be protected here at home, end quote. So did these pleas cause Governor Sparks to do the right thing? Don't be silly, of course not. Sparks can be found in Alabama history books as someone who helped ratify the Boswell Amendment, which made it all but impossible for most African Americans and poor whites to register to vote. Sparks only agreed to reluctantly launch an investigation once the tumult had reached a fever pitch. His interest didn't seem at all centered on doing right by Reese. He just wanted to avoid another Scottsboro situation. And if he had hoped to keep this investigation quiet, those hopes were dashed as the Committee for Equal Justice proclaimed the news far and wide. With their announcement, the Montgomery-based activists, Rosa Parks, E.D. Nixon, members of the NAACP, and prominent African Americans, began to raise money for Reese's defense. In addition to collecting funds, they held mass meetings, circulated petitions, and folded, stamped, and sent out mailers. Not only would this give Reese Taylor the best possible chance, but it would also train dozens of activists on best practices of grassroots organizing, skills they would use again a few years down the line. While their focus was primarily on Reese's case, Edie Nixon, the chair of the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP, continued to remind whoever would listen that she was but one of his files of Black women reporting what he called, quote, horror tales of white male degradation of the Negro women of Montgomery and Lower Alabama, end quote. E.G. Jackson, the editor of the Alabama Tribune, told the Chicago Defender that in addition to the trauma these attacks placed upon Black women, they also heavily impacted Black men. Jackson said, quote, "We Negro men feel powerless. The weight of hundreds of years hangs over us like so much iron. We would be superhuman if we alone could lift it off our shoulders," end quote. Governor Sparks sent two private investigators to Abbeville in December 1944. J.V. Kitchens and N.W. Kimbrough first spoke with the law, including the sheriff. And while the sheriff was willing to commit that, in his opinion, the crime was committed, as alleged by the victim, he claimed that no additional facts could be ascertained. Not only that, but the sheriff also told the investigators that he would not allow them to interview any of the suspects. Sheriff Gamble said there's no need. He had already arrested the seven men accused of attacking Reese anyway. Then, because assholes are gonna asshole, Gamble pulled Kitchens and Kimbrough aside. He wanted to let them know that Reese was, quote, nothing but a whore around Abbeville, and had been treated for some time by the health officer of Henry County for venereal disease, end quote. And if that wasn't enough, he also called Willie Taylor a layabout who never worked and said he had threatened Reese's husband with jail time for vagrancy. Luckily, other whites in Abbeville contradicted the sheriff's story. Mr. W.H. Carr sometimes offered Reese work and told the investigators that the Taylors were good workers and always stayed in their place. Others painted a picture of Reese as an upstanding, respectable woman who abided by the town's racial and sexual mores. Those interviews, plus a quick search of the sheriff's records, told Kitchens and Kimbrough that the sheriff had been lying. He had lied about arresting the suspects, and he had lied about arresting Reese for sex work. When they confronted the sheriff, he said, "It's a bad case," as if that explained anything. On December 18th, Sparks' two investigators returned, accompanied by the Assistant Attorney General, John Harris. Sheriff Gamble suddenly remembered that the Taylors were upstanding citizens, and he had never had any trouble with Reese. He still insisted that he had arrested the suspects that fateful evening, but Kitchens and Kimbrough decided to do their own questioning. Four of the seven repeated the story they had told months earlier. They had had sex with Reese, they said, but she was a sex worker. Five said Reese had gotten into the car of her own volition. Their stories went something like this, as read by an actor in The Rape of Reese Taylor.
"There was no gun in the car, and no one put a gun on her. When we got to the place where we had intercourse with her, Lovett asked her to undress, and she undressed willingly and without protest."
Hugo Wilson, the owner of the car used in the crime, said he wasn't even there that night and claimed he didn't know anything about it. But then the investigators spoke to Joe Culpepper, whose version of that night was surprisingly closer to Reese's version. He said that the men had been talking about getting a woman and were driving down the road when they saw two women walking. They initially didn't see Wes Daniel. Culpepper said that Herb Lovett forced Reese into and out of the car at gunpoint. He told them that Lovett held the gun on her as they forced her to undress, and she was crying and asking them to let her go home to her husband and her baby. He didn't seem to remember anything about Reese being a sex worker or about paying her for money for sex until the detectives asked him about it. Then he quickly included the fact, but he couldn't remember who collected the money or how much they paid her. Armed with statements from the suspects, signed affidavits from at least three eyewitnesses, proof that the sheriff had lied, and Joe Culpepper's signed admission of coercion, the investigators had given good old Chauncey enough to order a second grand jury hearing. Assistant AG John Harris, who had now been to Abbeville, was charged with the daunting task of convincing 12 white Alabama men to indict 7 other white Alabama men. Harris met with the Committee for Equal Justice to discuss strategy, but as he left, committee members felt Harris was more concerned about external pressures, particularly northern pressures, than the innocence or guilt of the defendants. Whether their instincts were right or the task before Harris was simply too tough to pull off, Harris failed to convince the second grand jury to indict any of the 7 suspects when he presented the case on February 14, 1945. While speaking to the Dothan Eagle, Harris said that this was the end of the road for the Recy Taylor case. It had been presented to 2 different grand juries without any indictments. Of course, it wasn't nearly that simple for Recy and Willie Taylor. Out of options for legal recourse or protection, they believed they were in imminent danger. Recy told Esther Cooper from the SNYC she was too scared to travel into town, and their mail arrived already opened. In what would be a drastic move in any other circumstance, members of the Montgomery chapter of the Committee for Equal Justice provided the Taylors with an apartment in Montgomery and helped Willie find a job in the capital city.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Letters continued to arrive at the State House urging Governor Sparks to act, but soon enough, they began to dwindle. When asked, the governor would reply that his hands were tied without a grand jury indictment. As America celebrated victory over Nazi Germany, members of the Committee for Equal Justice had to quietly admit amongst themselves that it was time to move on. They agreed that they needed to broaden the scope of their work, especially as reports of the rapes and assaults of other black women poured in daily. Recy, of course, didn't have the option of moving on from her rape. In an interview with NPR from 2011, Recy told host Michelle Martin that after that night in 1944, she didn't go out at night and she was afraid of living in Abbeville anymore because she was scared something else would happen. Eventually, according to the New York Times, the Taylors moved to Central Florida, where Recy got a job picking oranges. After moving, she and Willie separated. He died in the early 1960s. Sadly, their daughter Joyce died in a car accident in 1967. Living several years in Winter Haven, Florida, Recy had 2 additional long-term relationships in her life. As she grew older and her health deteriorated, she was prompted to move back to Abbeville to live with relatives. With Danielle McGuire's hugely important book, At the End of the Street, Black Women, Rape, and Resistance, A New History of the Civil Rights Movement from Rosa Parks to the Rise of Black Power, Recy's harrowing tale finally got the national attention it deserved 67 years after it happened. The book also delved into the role sexual assault of black women has played in American history since the Second World War. Published in 2011, when Recy was 92 years old, the book shed crucial light on a criminal epidemic and finally triggered some official apologies. On March 21, 2011, the city of Abbeville held a press conference to offer an official apology to Recy Taylor, who didn't attend. Her younger brother, Robert Corbett, however, still lived in Abbeville and stood directly in front of the podium. At 74, Robert was around 7 when his sister was raped, but he was still angry, saying, quote, "They tried to make her look like a whore and she was a Christian lady," end quote. According to Alabama.com, Recy told the Associated Press she believed all the men responsible were dead, but she would like an apology from the state. Joining city officials was State Rep Dexter Grimsley, who offered his own personal apology. 3 days later, Grimsley co-sponsored a bill in the state legislature, H.J.R. 194, entitled Expressing Regret for the State of Alabama's Involvement in the Failure to Prosecute Crimes Committed Against Recy Taylor. Among the many whereases were details about Robert Corbett remembering not being able to play freely in his front yard as a child, as well as the, quote, deplorable lack of justice being a source of shame for all Alabamians, end quote. The bill continued, declaring the state's failure to act was and is morally abhorrent and repugnant, and that the legislature profoundly regretted the role the government played in failing to prosecute the crimes. Of course, it ended with one final provision, which clearly stated that this apology was not an endorsement for reparations. As Danielle McGuire wrote, while Recy Taylor's case did not succeed in short-term justice for her, quote, it was the largest and best organized of many efforts to draw attention to the ruthless heart of the racial caste system, end quote. McGuire's book, as well as Nancy Bersky's documentary based on it, spread word of what Recy had endured, and her story was resurrected again during the Me Too movement of the late 2010s. This is Oprah Winfrey talking about her decision to include Recy's tale in an award speech in 2018.
I didn't even know who Recy Taylor was until maybe a couple of years ago. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to use her as a part of my Golden Globe speech is because I wanted everybody to know that the Me Too movement didn't just start now, that there have been women who have endured and women who have not only survived but thrived in the face of injustices for years, and that her case is one that never found justice.
Those who worked on the Committee for Equal Justice for Mrs. Recy Taylor learned how to organize, how to fundraise, how to create a movement. Nearly all involved would see their names indexed again in history, but this time under the Montgomery bus boycott, a boycott that lasted 11 months and desegregated the city's buses. Rosa Parks, Edie Nixon, Ralph Abernathy, these names echo through history. But does Recy Taylor's? While far more know Rosa Parks' name than Recy's, with McGuire's book, The Me Too Movement and a Brighter Light being shown on rape injustices, more are learning about Recy every day. Recy Taylor died on December 28, 2017, just 3 days shy of her 99th birthday. In her final years, she saw McGuire's book published and was interviewed by outlets around the world, her name again appearing in print, now digitally, in multiple languages. She also traveled back to Abbeville one last time to attend the Mother's Day services at Rock Hill Holiness Church, the same church she had left with Fannie Daniels more than six decades earlier. During the service, she was surprised by the state resolution of apology, which, the San Diego Union-Tribune said, she planned to keep in a trunk with other items of special significance. Before she finally settled back at home in Florida, Recy made one final trip. She and her granddaughter, Mary Owens, traveled to Washington, D.C., where the duo were able to tour the Obama White House. According to the Union Tribune, she had a framed photo of the Obamas at home and wanted to see the White House of the first Black president of the United States. They weren't invited by the Obamas, just taking the public tour. Mary called her grandmother a hidden hero and a woman of integrity before simply saying, "She has overcome." To research this story, historian and writer Jen Erdman read Danielle McGuire's 2011 book, At the Dark End of the Street, as well as contemporary news stories, particularly from the Chicago Defender and retrospective news articles, including a few from the San Diego Union-Tribune.
Crime
Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rassman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're at centuriespod, and check out our Crimes of the Centuries podcast Facebook page.